Welcome to Context and Clarity. I am Chuck.
I am Karen.
I used to be a Democrat.
I used to be a Republican.
I'm still a liberal.
And I'm still a conservative. But since our parties left us, we're not really sure what we are. But we do know this. As Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we are not enemies. We are friends.
We are friends. Happy... Has there been any of your holidays lately?
No, there hasn't. I mean, Valentine's Day was this week, but I don't really... It seems like that should be offensive. I think that's offensive.
You have a lot of parties and a lot of holidays. That's what I'm saying.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's nothing at all wrong with that.
Yeah, you know what there is something wrong with, though?
I don't know.
The press conference that happened today. There was something very, very wrong with that.
That was really weird. The whole thing was just weird.
It was something, that's for sure.
I liked the part where he said, I love tariffs. And I thought, tariffs are like the measles, you know? Tariffs are like antibiotics that you have to take to fix something. It's like, oh, I love taking antibiotics. No. You know, tariffs may be necessary. Mm-hmm. But nobody loves them.
Well, I'm just waiting for him to refer to himself as the tariff sheriff. I really am, because he uses these little rhymes, you know, and it surprises me that he hasn't referred to himself as the tariff sheriff. I think it's going to happen. Pretty sure.
Are you old enough to remember when Jesse Jackson ran for president?
Vaguely.
The thing I admired the most about Jesse Jackson is he could make any words rhyme.
Oh, I know. I remember that. I do. I remember that.
I mean, I used to love to watch him speak, just his cadence and the way he would make things rhyme. He was just really good.
It was fun to watch.
He didn't make much sense, but
but it sounded good.
It did sound good. I used to love to listen to him.
Yeah.
Well, what are we going to talk about this week, Karen?
Well, we are going to talk about the national emergency that was issued today. So we know that President Trump, he just declared a national emergency in order to fund his border wall. And I just want to say quickly that I called this when I was talking to you, if you remember, when everybody was saying, you know, kind of making fun of him for caving in with the government shutdown. And I said, this is going to make him really angry and he's going to do an emergency declaration just because he's ticked.
And everybody really, I mean, if you look back just in, you know, a week ago in the newspaper articles, most people didn't really believe he would do that.
Right. And that's why I thought he would, because I also think that this is a diversion tactic. I have a feeling that Mueller's report is going to be dropped pretty soon. And this generated a pretty hefty news cycle. So we'll see. We will see what happens, but we do know that he just declared this emergency order, and the words national emergency definitely evoke very extreme authoritarian images. But what does it all mean really? What is the history and the legal precedent, and what are the implications? First, remember that this is a president who knows how to drive media ratings and who utilizes the art of diversion whenever possible. So sometimes his dramatic proclamations are like a lot of whipped topping with very little ice cream.
Now, see, I like the whipped topping better than the ice cream. So I don't know if that's a good analogy.
Okay. Well, you get the point, though, right?
I suppose I do, but that suddenly Trump turned good to me. So I'm confused now. I have an internal struggle going on.
Okay, what about cake? I mean, would you like it if there was no...
I like cake without icing.
Okay, there you go. He's all icing and no cake.
There you go.
Is that better? All right. Yes. We'll go with that.
Let's start with acknowledging that the national emergency declarations in general are pretty common. And according to the Brennan Justice Center, presidents have declared at least 59 states of emergency, not counting natural disasters for weather. And this is going back to 76 when the National Emergencies Act was put into place. Now, first of all, it's important to understand that an emergency declaration is an executive action, we hear that term a lot, and we also hear about executive orders and executive memos, but aren't they basically all the same thing, Karen?
Yes and no. All are executive orders, but they have varying degrees of power. An executive order is a specific type of presidential action. It's an official, legally binding mandate that's passed down from the president to federal agencies under the executive branch. Executive orders are printed in the Federal Register, and they're numbered consecutively for the sake of keeping them straight. Essentially, an executive order gives agencies instructions on how to interpret and carry out federal law. Before we go on and discuss the nuances between action, memos, and proclamations, let's take a minute to just back up and explain the Federal Register. The Office of the Federal Register, which is part of the National Archives and Records Administration, publishes regulations in the Federal Register every workday. It's a centralized publication system for executive branch documents. The idea for the register started during the Great Depression, when Congress began enacting a host of legislation that gave executive branch agencies increased authority to regulate. With the flood of new regulations, it was difficult for the public and federal agencies to know which regulations were effective and enforceable. This problem led to the Supreme Court case of Panama Refining Company versus Ryan, which ultimately resulted with Congress enacting the Federal Register Act in July of 1935. The FRA created the Federal Register as the official daily publication for presidential documents and executive agency rule and notice documents.
So let's get back to the question at hand. Executive action is a catch-all phrase. It describes any action taken by the president, including executive orders or trying to chip on from the fairway, which he does. That's most of the executive action that we see from this executive. But anyway, the term also encompasses executive memorandums and proclamations, which I make often. I make official executive proclamations.
You do. Mm-hmm.
So how are memos and proclamations different? Well, an executive memo is an order, but does not have an established protocol on how it's issued. It does not have to be submitted to the Federal Register. And because of that, it's much harder to track.
Right. And if you look them up, the amount of presidential memos is massive. We don't really hear about those in the news as much. And it's interesting because they don't have a tracking system that is nearly as sophisticated.
Right. But they carry the same weight.
Mm-hmm.
A proclamation is an executive order that is basically ceremonial fluff and usually does not have a legal framework.
That is what you do, correct? Isn't that what you said you do? You make official proclamations?
Well, I make proclamations as to how these scripts should go and how these shows could go, and they must be fluff because they're completely ignored all the time.
Ceremonial fluff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good example.
Ceremonial fluff, yes.
Yes.
So an example of this would be a presidential proclamation, the flag be flown at half staff to honor a former president who's died. Now, it's good form to follow, but there are no legal repercussions for ignoring it.
Unlike if I ignore your proclamations for the podcast, there are repercussions for it.
Swift and severe repercussions.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, executive action is nothing new. In 1792, which rhymes with nothing new, in 1792, nothing new happened. Okay. In 1792, Washington used the Militia Act to take over state militias during the Whiskey Rebellion. It is well known that President Abraham Lincoln established a blockade on the ports of southern states and suspended habeas corpus without congressional approval. Franklin Roosevelt gave the most executive actions. In fact, executive actions are so common that only one president did not issue an executive order. And that president was William Henry Harrison. That was the president that had the longest inauguration speech, the one that was super long and in the rain. And he died of pneumonia just a month after going into office.
Well, look at the history of national emergency orders. Now, if you go to the Lawfare blog, that gives a great overview on this. All presidential authority comes from the Constitution or an act of Congress. As our Constitution contains no general emergency powers provision, presidents must look to congressional acts for the authority to act beyond the normal limits of their powers. By 73, Congress enacted over 470 statutes granting the president special powers in times of crisis. Now, these powers lay dormant, much like my superpowers, until the president declared a state of emergency, at which point all would be available for his use. And at the time, the president could declare an emergency as he alone saw fit. No procedures or rules constrained his discretion on that. He could just declare an emergency.
On December 16th, 1950, President Harry S. Truman. Hey, Chuck.
Yes.
Did I ever tell you that I was born in the same hospital that Harry Truman died in?
Really?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Amazing? Me?
Yeah. No, it's true.
Wow. That's like on, now we've gotten up to, it's on every third episode. So yeah, keep going.
I just wanted to, remind you in case you forgot. He declared a state of emergency in response to Korean hostilities, but the emergency did not end with the war. By 1972, it was still in effect, and it was being used to wage war in Vietnam. So the U.S. Senate convened a special committee to investigate. The committee discovered three other active emergencies, each of which independently gave the president access to the entire set of emergency powers. The committee decided the crisis provisions gave too much authority to rule the country without constitutional process. So, in an attempt to remedy this, Congress enacted the National Emergency Act of 1976. The act did several things. First, the act revoked any powers granted to the president under the four states of emergency still active at the time. Next, it outlined procedures for invoking these powers in the future. For example, a president must specifically declare a national emergency in accordance with the act and identify the statutory basis for each emergency power he intends to use.
Now, before we continue here, let's go to Chuck's philosophy corner, Karen. Because if you look at the philosophy of centralized emergency power, who would you say is the most influential philosopher on the founding fathers?
Well, I think politically speaking, it would be John Locke.
That's right. They were deeply influenced by him. So Locke had kind of a weird view on this. His view was that the executive, and in this case, the president, had very wide latitude in using emergency powers. And these powers were not just limited to wartime or even situations that were not urgent. I mean, the president just had emergency powers that he could use any time. And the common good was a good enough reason for the president to invoke emergency powers. So if you just look at that criteria alone, Trump would be correct in declaring, because he feels that this is for the common good, right? He'd be correct using his emergency powers. But Locke set conditions, and those conditions were that there was no legislative framework in place to address that situation. So in the case of the wall, there is a legal framework in place. Congress allocates the funds, and they have refused to do so. Both the Republican and Democrat houses have refused to allocate those funds.
Right.
So it would not meet that criteria. Locke said that the executive should be able to use emergency powers anytime, basically, for any reason, if there was no legislative framework in place to address that, to
take care of it. Right. So it had to be completely independent.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Right. But he believed in a pretty strong executive. Not nearly this strong.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's get back to the act itself. Each state of emergency is supposed to end automatically 1 year after its declaration, unless the president publishes a notice of renewal in the Federal Register within 90 days of the termination date and then notifies Congress of that renewal. Finally, the act required that each House of Congress meet every 6 months to consider a vote to end the state of emergency. However, Congress has never actually met for this vote. The act was pretty successful in that presidents started to follow protocol and started to outline the specific emergency powers that they plan to use. But it was not successful in that it did not put a stop to a kind of a perpetual state of emergency. Not only does Congress not meet to review status, presidents just automatically renew provisions, which renders the termination provision kind of useless. So now, if you add in this current state of emergency, we actually have 32 state of emergencies going on.
I'm just going to list off a few here that have been put in by different presidents, and they have a weird way of titling them.
Right.
Carter had one, and it was called the National Emergency with Respect to Iran. And that was in response to the hostage crisis in Iran. Right.
And these are all ones that are currently
active, going. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Clinton, who issued 10 in his 8 years, had one called the National Emergency with Respect to Regulations of the Anchorage and Movement of Vessels with Respect to Cuba. And that was after civilian planes were shot down near Cuba. So that was Clinton. Let's jump to Bush Jr. And I know you hate when I call him that, so that's why I call him that. On September 23rd, 2001, he declared a national emergency. The national emergency with respect to persons who commit, threaten to commit, or support terrorism. And of course, that was in response to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. So you have those. Bush had 10. Clinton had 10. So far, this is Trump's fourth. So that he's kind of on pace to beat these guys.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
and that's kind of a continuing pattern. It seems like since Clinton, and then you have Bush that expanded presidential powers a little bit, and Obama expanded them more, and now Trump is really pushing them even further.
Right. As soon as someone sets that standard, the next person just reaches it and goes higher. And that's really what makes this so dangerous.
Well, it's kind of funny because it's not to make a joke out of it, but having the three boys, you know, I was pretty hard on the three boys growing up. I'll admit that. But I always told people if one boy just went 1 foot beyond the line, if you didn't jerk him back, if you just let that go, the next boy would be 10 feet beyond the line.
Right.
And then the next boy would be so far away, you wouldn't be able to see him. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we've done with our presidents. We've given them, each one has gotten more. We've never reined in presidential power.
Right. Yeah. Well, when it comes to why they're still on the books, it's kind of hard to find definitive reasoning behind it, why it keeps getting renewed, but it's my guess that the renewals are related to funding and kind of skeleton programs that are left to mitigate whatever emergency was addressed. And also, it's just not priority for a lot of people. And that's kind of terrifying to know that there's so much power just kind of lying about for someone to grab that knows what they're doing. And that's disturbing to me. I think there's a lot of people behind the scenes politically that know how to manipulate these things.
Well, you're going to get into this, the danger of this, so I won't.
Right. Now that we know all this, I'll know the history and kind of what we're dealing with, what does it have to do with the current situation? Well, really the most important thing to know is that the National Emergency Act sets forth a very specific set of procedures to follow, and it requires a legal basis for the declaration.
Right. And this is where we're going to step into opinion territory rather than straight history and fact. And these are our observations and concerns. And Karen's go on for a full 2 pages. I have 3 sentences because I'm more laid back. So.
Well, I think that really people who claim to be conservatives should be the ones that are raising the battle cry about this, because honestly, liberals tend to favor centralized power as a general rule. So because it is President Trump that is doing this, you're going to hear a lot from them. But had he been a different president and a different issue, it may not be something that would be so much of a problem. But conservatives should have a problem no matter what.
I think conservatives, if they're really honest with themselves and look themselves in the eye, in the mirror, they know that if Obama did something like this, they would be running around like their hair was on fire.
Yes, exactly. That's my whole point. I just think that they need to be rising up and speaking out against this and doing something about it. And especially those in the Senate, in the Congress and Senate, they need to do something. I say that over and over again, but this is really a dire situation. So I think the first thing I want to talk about is, where is the evidence that we're actually in a humanitarian crisis? The president alluded to Homeland Security numbers, but they're really nowhere to be found, what he's referring to in reference to the border exactly. The numbers that are listed on the White House memo that are regarding this issue, when it talks about crime and they list the crime statistics, they're utilizing numbers of those that are already here, not those that are coming through the border. And the reason why they have to use those numbers is because the numbers of criminals coming through the border, the number of those that are known to be criminals, are minuscule, actually. We looked over the government's own numbers, okay? We got it from the Border Patrol site. And the fact is that the claims the president is making on this, it's simply untrue. I mean, it just is. If you look up the statistics of the sizes of the caravans and how many people, there are not more people coming through the border than have ever been here before. That is simply untrue. The claims of criminals and the drug trafficking is actually, it's untrue. There is sex trafficking coming through all the borders, and it is a huge problem, but it is not what he is using is the basis. There is no data-driven evidence to back up his claims.
Right. And so much of that is just coming through ports of entry.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. I mean, there's going to be a certain level of that no matter what. And here's the problem with that. If no statistics or data-driven evidence is being used to back up the claims of a humanitarian crisis, what will keep this from happening over and over again, dependent on the ideological whimsy of whoever is in office? This is what Republicans need to realize here. I've seen some Republicans mocking AOC's Green Deal, right?
Right.
You need to realize that her arguments, what she outlines in her proposal, those are the exact same arguments that are being used by the president regarding the border. The whole idea that this is a humanitarian crisis and that it has to be approached in that way.
Well, and yes, that you raise a good point, because you look at her Green Deal. Mm-hmm. Who is to say that the next Democratic president is not going to say, you know what? Climate change is a national emergency.
Right. And propose regulations that other people may consider stifling.
I mean, just put them into effect under an emergency order.
Mm-hmm.
And think about what would have happened, again, had Obama been in office and we had a school shooting and he declared a national emergency and banned AR-15s.
Right.
I mean, using this logic,
mm-hmm.
because go back to the ones that I read, those were all legitimate threats. I mean, Iran, mm-hmm. Cuba, the terrorism one that Bush had.
Right. There was, and they were broad. I think Bush's especially was very broad. But yeah, I mean, they were all specific and they all had data backing up the problem.
Right. And the president can't go so far as to, you know, suspend habeas corpus like Lincoln did. That would not stand up in a court. So he couldn't stop overturn the Second Amendment. But he could really limit the number of guns that were allowable under a national emergency.
Right.
And then you would almost have to have a constitutional amendment to overturn that.
Mm-hmm. Right. The precedent being set here is going to set the stage for anything to be called a humanitarian crisis, and that will allow for constitutional circumvention. And it's not okay. It's a serious, serious problem. The conspiracy theorist in me, which I try to shut her up, but she's pretty loud.
She's got the tinfoil on her head again.
I'm starting to think, after all the research that I did, that this was actually the plan for a while. I honestly don't think there was ever really a goal to negotiate a deal. The language of the main statute requires that the troops have been sent in prior to the declaration. I never understood why troops were sent in for a migrant caravan. That was actually pretty typical. At the time, I thought it was a political theater thing to push like midterm turnout. But when I look at it now, I actually think that it's possible that this was a long game set up by some of the inside circle to achieve this goal. One of the other requirements for this particular statute was that the Secretary of Defense had to authorize it. We don't have a confirmed acting Secretary of Defense. And so, therefore, the president could put whoever he wanted into that role to authorize whatever he wanted. I find it disturbing and very, very...
It is peculiar that we made a big deal of sending troops down there that really did nothing, but that was a requirement for this, to have this called a national emergency.
Right.
So, yeah, your conspiracy theory actually makes some sense.
Right.
I hate to say that. I never believed I would ever say that.
Right. The thing that I didn't mention, I meant to mention this earlier, and this might make what I'm saying kind of have a more context. The statute that this particular state of emergency is based on is 10 U.S.C. 2808A. And this statute says that in a war declaration or a declaration of emergency that requires the use of armed forces, that's it. It is predicated on that. You have to have the armed forces be a part of it before you can declare it.
It has to be so severe that armed forces were involved.
Right, are involved. Right. The Secretary
of
Defense.
He got armed forces involved.
Exactly. And then the Secretary of Defense has to authorize a military construction project, and that will authorize funding. So the legal basis for this requires those two things. And lo and behold, in the last few months, those two things were both put into place to make that happen. I just find that very, very, very coincidental.
Your conspiracy theory sometimes makes sense. I hate to say that.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. But I don't think it's something that he planned out. But I think that there's some people whispering to the president that knew exactly how to make this work. And I think this was their plan all along. I'm starting to really think that. Might make me a little bit crazy, but I just don't.
No,
it's just
that
weird
is not
to me.
What makes you crazy, Karen.
There's so many things that make me crazy. The next thing that I noticed is the comment that the president made in the middle of his speech that revealed his true intent. When he said, I didn't have to do this. You know, I had 2020 in mind and I just wanted to get it done faster.
That was pretty damning.
Right.
I think.
Yeah, it was. It was very damning. And it obviously revealed what he really wanted. And I think that could work against him when people start to have lawsuits against him and things like that. I think that it could work against him in the future. And again, I just want to reiterate, I think conservatives have to stand up to this. We are the ones who speak out against executive action. This standard is the very thing so many people feared. And this is supposed to be our battle cry, that we do not let this happen. Where are the voices? I need to hear the voices.
Well, they'll hear yours.
They
over
will.
And over and
I'm going to say what I have to say about it.
Yeah. Well, here's my view. Everyone knows that this is ridiculous. I mean, everyone knows. But the question is whether Republicans have the courage to rein him in. And I think this is really going to hurt them in 2020.
Oh, definitely.
But
yeah.
Because McConnell went on the floor of the Senate before the agreement was worked out and said, hey, just go with the agreement and have the president do the national emergency. And that was it was a political play that I think is going to backfire on him.
What is conservatism? If it's not standing against a bloated, centralized government and executive power. This is the core of what conservative values are supposed to be. This is it.
We have a group now with McConnell and with Trump. They care nothing about the norms of governing. They care nothing about those norms. Well, and they will shred them to advance their cause.
It's up to us to change that. And I just, there is no, being a conservative and being a Republican are no longer the same thing. And anybody who thinks it is sadly mistaken, because this is not a conservative action. And if Republicans stand for it and say it is good, it is creating so much hypocrisy that no one can take you seriously in 2020.
Well, and we looked at all of the, you know, you go back to the FDR days, and this is the first time that the inability to pass a piece of signature legislation had been turned into a national emergency. And again, I'll go back to Clinton. His first 2 years were a fight over health care that he never won. What if he would have decided health care is a national emergency and implements a national health care system?
Right.
That's not beyond the pale here.
Right. Everybody talked about the mandate and how terrible that was. Look at what's happening here. This is so much worse. It's
right. Mm. And you had Bush Senior, who and Junior, both part of their platforms were to overhaul Social Security. Mm-hmm. What if they just decided that it was a national emergency? Social Security was now a national emergency.
Right. Right. We are dealing with a president who really has no respect for the Constitution. His cabinet, most of them are acting members of the cabinet. So they weren't subject to confirmation. And he said himself that he liked it that way. Right. And now we're seeing this level of executive action. He does not want the constraints and the checks and balances of government. You know, that's the difference. So many public servants, and I know a lot of people complain about every congressperson and every senator, and I don't think that they're all terrible. I think that there are some public servants among them, and those public servants love the way our government is structured. They love the fact that there is a checks and balances system. And that is what makes the fundamental framework of our government so cool and what has kept it going for so long. And there is no respect for that in this administration. There's not. And it is deeply disturbing.
In 2020, again, I think it's going to come back to haunt them in 2020, because there was a blue wave. People don't want to say it, but there was a blue wave in the midterms. By the time they got sorted out, it was a blue wave. And what people are going to see, one of the reasons that people voted for Democrats was because they felt like the House was not keeping the president in check, that there was no oversight. Now, the House is going to do something to try to stop this, and it's going to die in the Senate. And I think politically, it's going to be very helpful to the Democrats, because they're going to see that there is no Republican oversight in the Senate. There's just none. You have Senators Rand Paul and other ones, a lot of senators coming out, but coming out and saying he should not have done this is different than taking action.
Right.
You can tweet all you want about what a bad idea it is. Well, mm-hmm. Are you, when there's a joint resolution passed and he vetoes it, are you going to break ranks and to create the supermajority?
Right.
It's one thing to talk on CNN, but mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a platform for the Democrats. And it's weird about this act, to get back to the language of the act, is so vague that it basically showed that the politicians who enacted it never expected it to be abused, because basically it's kind of like the circular language. If the president feels there's a national emergency, he shall declare a national emergency. It doesn't set forth a criteria.
Well, it does. That actually the act does set forth a bit of criteria. It basically just kind of set forth a boundary, like a fence, a protocol that they had to follow.
Yeah, but they kind of assumed that a national emergency was going to be self-evident.
Right. Well, they trusted, just like you just said, they trusted that it was not going to be abused because whoever was president would understand the gravity
of
what they were doing.
They did not foresee a Trump, and they did not foresee a Congress that was so polarized that they would refuse to act.
Right.
So, and we're talking about this a lot, but this happening really depends on the president being reelected in 2020, because you're going to have so many lawsuits coming out of this. None of it is going to get settled before that time.
Right.
So there's a good chance that this doesn't even happen. And when you look at the big picture of things, I mean, a wall is going to cost, you know, $30 billion. How much of a wall did he just get? And you said, you talked about a diversion. Mm-hmm. I think the diversion is how badly he got beat by digging in on that $5 billion number.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, he got less money in this second bill to avert a shutdown than he had on the table when he kept the government closed for 35 days.
Right.
This national emergency is a diversion to distract from really how badly he got beat. How badly Pelosi beat him on the budget thing.
Right. This is a failure.
It is.
Make no mistake. This is a sign of failure. This is what you do when you can't win the game. So you declare yourself the winner.
Well, you change your rules.
Right. And this is not winning. This is not making a deal. This is bullying to get your way. That's what this is.
Right. But it does distract from how badly he was... How badly he was beaten by Pelosi. He was just outgamed by Pelosi on it because she knew that the Republicans were already paying a little bit of a price for having the government shut down for 35 days. Mm-hmm. They don't want to see it again. So they gave him even less money.
Right.
And
well,
you went to the press conference, or you didn't go, but I mean, you were talking about the press conference and is the way that he talked, well, in other areas, I have so much money, I don't know what to do with it. I mean, that does not give you, that's not competence. I have so much money for security over here, I don't know what to do with it. Well, maybe you should have a game plan if you're going to have all this money. So every time he has a press conference like that, he looks more and more unhinged to me. This is going to sound like, if you're a stranger listening in, this will sound like a left-leaning podcast, but what we're just saying is the truth. I mean, it's really just the truth.
It is.
So if the truth is anti-Trump, it's the truth.
Right. I mean, anybody who's been listening to the podcast for a long time knows that I am not a fan of President Trump, and there's a lot of reasons, but the main reason is that he is not a conservative.
Right.
And I feel like he corrupted everything that I have voted Republican the majority of my life, and he corrupted everything I stood for, and it makes me sick to my stomach. It makes me so angry that he is the face of something that I formerly believed in, and I'm not going to apologize for that because he's not a conservative. His policies are not conservative. They're not. And I'm not saying that there, I think there have been some people in his cabinet that have made some good decisions and made some strides in the right direction in some areas. I'm not saying that there hasn't been some inadvertent success.
Well, you have Kavanaugh, and you know, you have the two Supreme Court justices that the conservatives are going to be pleased with. As a rule, they're going to say we did get the two Supreme Court seats, and I think
that they got the justices that had the ideology that they preferred.
Right.
I wouldn't say that they liked some of the controversy that came with
it. Right. But they did get two Supreme Court seats. And
And there's some foreign policy things. And the tax cuts
that they are very happy with.
Right. But
that was all driven by legislators, not by Trump.
Exactly. And the deeper core of what he has changed and what he has brought about is the opposite of what conservatism is supposed to be about. It's just, well, it's really, really scary.
What happens so next here then, Karen?
Right. What can happen next is that there is a bipartisan resolution, and that could stop the declaration, but then it could be vetoed. A veto would need a supermajority to be overturned. But I will say this. A bipartisan resolution would also speak highly. It would say, we are not okay with this. I think that even if they know they're going to be vetoed, it's something that needs to happen. It needs to happen because people need to see that the Congress and Senate do not support this.
Well, I think what will be interesting to see is if the House passes one, if McConnell lets one come to the Senate floor.
That's the big question right there. Also, Congress could draft a concurrent resolution to terminate the state of emergency. That's a lot more complicated and it will take a while, but that is a possibility. Also,
and that Congress could get vetoed too.
Right. Also, Congress can sue. It probably won't go anywhere, but they can keep it in court for a really long time. One very valid legal route to take is whether or not the president's declaration is legal, plaintiffs could still directly challenge Defense Department action that they would argue is in violation of the Military Construction Codification Act.
Right. And, we looked into it's a very complicated thing that we can
but
that is one of the flaws and one of the things that will come up in court.
Right. It's definitely a loophole that can be utilized.
Well, all we know for sure is that this is just the beginning, which means this is not all we have to say about that. We're going to be talking about whatever happens in the future.
Right.
But for right now,
For right now, that is not all I have to say about that, because I want to add one thing. And I like to end on a note of hope. And I am going to say one hopeful thing. I think one positive thing that can come from all of this is that it is causing people, it is causing the citizenry to research how our government is put together, why certain things happen and what they can do about it. And that is a good thing. I mean, when I was doing research today, I saw searches that people had been doing, and I'm very glad that this is causing people to be interested in their government. And sometimes it takes something like this to drive interest and to bring people back to what makes our country amazing. And that is the framework and the checks and balances. And if it teaches people to look at that and to learn that and to bring it back, then that is a positive thing.
Well, I think you make a very good point there, because I think there are a lot of people walking around when it happened saying, can he do that?
Right.
Can he really do that?
Right.
So that's not all we have to say about it, but thank you for listening.
Yes. Bye, everybody.
Bye.